Okay, so this is our 49th week. I got to misnumbering as a result of the Jubilee there, but Jerry set me straight. So it is 49th week now, if you count the Jubilee weeks, which we are devoting to related material at least. And so tonight we'll be looking at pages 668 through 682 in the Chronological Study Bible, which, as you can see on the slide, will involve Hezekiah, whom we've been looking at for a couple of weeks, Manasseh, who is his son, and I think without argument the worst king that Israel ever had, and then Josiah, who is described in Scripture as the best king they ever had, and then Zephaniah, who is the prophet of this particular time frame. So, as we have been repeating every week, trying to bury certain landmarks in biblical history into our psyches, the Assyrians now, in 722 B.C., have wiped out the northern kingdom. They're gone. It's over. And so now Assyria is threatening the southern kingdom. They've had, in fact, enormous success and completely encircled all the territory surrounding Jerusalem. But as we saw last week, and we saw again in the week, this week's reading, failed, Sennacherib did, when he got actually to the walls and gates of Jerusalem, wanted to make an attempt on the city itself. He lost 185,000 soldiers, and so he returns in shame, but he does not return to his home with any desire to give up. Unfortunately, his life gets cut short by whom? Two of his own sons, yeah, they kill him, and a third son takes over. But Assyria will march on with its desires to be, the world power and conquering this region entirely. Now, I'm going to zoom in on our little timeline here to the area that has been our subject for quite a while now. The days of Isaiah, Micah, Amos, Hosea, the days of Hezekiah, about whom we've spent so much time, are all right here at the tail end of the 700s B.C., with Hezekiah reigning for 29 years and spanning the century break right there. He will live a few years down into the 600s B.C. So these are now the waning years, if you will, of the southern kingdom of Judah, but we're still looking at 120 years from the death of Hezekiah to the actual Babylonian captivity. So we're still looking at a fair amount of time here, which God has chosen to reveal a great deal about. So we have just a tremendous amount of information. This will be, then, the third week in a row that we've had duplicated material where Kings and Chronicles are overlapping and telling us the same story in two different books. Chronological Bible, in my view, is weaker than the narrated Bible, with which many of you are also familiar, another chronological arrangement. It's not terrible in this respect, but the chronological Bible does not take nearly as long to read. The narrated Bible does not take as long to read. Where you have, identical stuff in more than one location, F. Legard Smith only records that duplicated material once rather than twice. So week after week now, you're reading and saying, well, I already read that. Well, yeah, you did. You just read it in a different book. And so he cuts out the duplicated things, Legard does, and has a more fluid reading that contains all of the unique information there. But for the third week in a row, we've kind of had extra time because we are reading this material over twice. So we're turning the corner now into the 600s B.C., and we'll be looking this week and then looking forward to next week as well. We're looking at Zephaniah. We've got some psalms that are going to be printed on the page for us here, or set into this time frame. Jeremiah's coming up next week. There's a gigantic and difficult, but very significant book. Nahum is on the way. Habakkuk is one of my favorite guys. Daniel, of course, is fascinating to everybody. And admittedly, a very difficult book because in a relatively few number of chapters, in 12 chapters, he's going to present material sometimes that is really head-scratching kind of stuff. So it'll be tormenting to us, as this is an overview. We don't have time to work with all of that. But all of these men, you know, are lying ahead, in our immediate future of the chronological time frame that we are in. So it's test time tonight. Yeah, you tell me. When did the United Kingdom split? There should be a roar in unison. When did the United Kingdom split? 930, there it is, B.C. Who died? Solomon. Who was his son? Rehoboam. And who didn't like the way he was handling things right from the beginning, and so he took 10 tribes and split. Who was that? Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, often called Jeroboam the first, as opposed to the second. So, 930 B.C., pretty significant moment as it changes everything in the relationship of the tribes. They've only had three kings, and already, you know, there is just all kinds of destruction and trouble that has resulted now with the kingdom being split. What are the two main names that the 10 northern tribes will be known by and you'll be seeing used interchangeably in the scriptures? Israel and Ephraim. So when you see Ephraim, you know, in these passages, that's not, or have been seeing Ephraim, that's not an individual as it was to begin with, but is representing those 10 northern tribes. What are the two southern tribes known as? Also two names. They're really the same name, but it's Judah or Judea. And by the way, what were those two tribes? Benjamin and Judah. Benjamin being really tiny, you know, and immediately adjacent there to Judah to the north. How long does Israel last? 208 years. All right, 208 years. And then we haven't emphasized it quite as much, but how long does Judah last? 344. Now really, you know, I like to keep hammering this while we have the opportunity here. I realize it isn't going to stick, but you see it every week, and you recognize the relativity of the extra time for Judah is apparently due to what? What did they have that the northern kingdom did never have? They had some good kings, and we've been reading about the two of the best, Hezekiah and Josiah, here in the last couple of weeks. So what year did Israel fall? I told you a little while ago, 722 B.C. When does Judah fall? I started introducing this. Hasn't happened yet. Lies in the future, quite a ways, in fact. But, in fact, 100 years away. But when do they come to an end? Three times. Start trying to remember this. Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon is going to come in at 606. He's going to do some things that have great biblical significance that we're told about there. But he doesn't succeed in completely, you know, ruining their ability to want a revolt. So he has to come back again in 597. And again, we have very significant biblical events that tell us about this and what happens at that time. And then they still don't give up. So 11 years later, in 586 B.C., he will come back again. And what's he going to do the third time? That is of the greatest significance. Yeah. Okay. But to what in particular? What do we do away with? That's when the temple will be destroyed. So we're looking far ahead, you know, right now, but thought I'd set that before you. So, we're going to take the next six pages as we start now, pages 668 to 673, and then I've just selected some excerpts here, and we're just going to go ahead and look at those excerpts, see some other bits and pieces about the reign of Hezekiah that are recorded in this week's reading, either not as fully or not as at all in our last week's reading. Bill?
Which one of those dates began the 70-year countdown?
Okay, Bill's asked a tremendously important question. Which one of these dates, 606, 597, or 586, begins the 70-year countdown that Jeremiah stipulated was how long they would be in captivity? Quite different from the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom is not going to be obliterated so fully. They're going into Babylonian captivity. They're coming out of Babylonian captivity, and they're going to start all over again. That's for sure. When do we begin this count? We begin that count right here and right here. It'll be a lot of fun. I'll tell you later. Okay. That's why I say these dates are significant, because God actually begins a 70-year countdown from both of those years, 606 and 586. I'll show you how. I'll show you why. And most of the reading that I've seen through the years really does not point it out either. So the 70 years captivity happens kind of twice. Isn't that intriguing? You're going to have to wait for that one. Okay, so pages 668 to 673, and again, since I get to be the teacher, I get to pick what I want to read. So if you have some other things here that you'd like to comment on as we go along, then certainly feel free to ask. But we're going to start tonight on page 668 with 2 Chronicles 29, and in the section there in the left-hand column, about halfway down, where Hezekiah cleanses the temple. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Now stop. What did that just tell you about the house of the Lord? What's that tell you about the temple? It's just fallen completely out of service. What had they done to the doors? It's like they boarded them up. You know, you can imagine the house that that they wanted to buy in It's a Wonderful Life. That kind of thing. And as you've been doing the reading, I'm hoping that's the very picture that you get. Time and again in this week's reading, we are told about the rubbish that's in the temple. We're told about how long it takes to purify the thing. And so it had fallen into a state of just horrific disrepair. They had idols, you know, that had cropped up all over everywhere. And they were now using the temple. And remember, when we say the temple, that includes a great deal more than just the sanctuary itself. Solomon had built all around that sanctuary. And they had three stories of storerooms around that thing. It was quite a structure, quite extensive, and so lots and lots and lots and lots of room for various people with who knows what sort of nefarious, you know, ideas would be able to use for their own purposes or just neglect altogether. So then, reading in verse 4, he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them in the east square and said to them, "Hear me, Levites. Now sanctify yourselves. Sanctify the house of the Lord God of your fathers, and carry out the rubbish from the holy place. For our fathers have trespassed and done evil in the eyes of the Lord our God. They've forsaken him, have turned their faces away from the dwelling place of the Lord, and turned their backs on him. They've also shut up the doors of the vestibule, put out the lamps, have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. Therefore, the wrath of the Lord fell upon Judah and Jerusalem. He's given them up to trouble, to desolation, and to jeering, as you see with your eyes. For indeed, because of this, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons, our daughters, and our wives are in captivity." Wait a minute! What city are we in? Jerusalem. I thought it didn't fall. Sennacherib lost 185,000 choice soldiers. They didn't take the city. So who are these people that are in captivity? Who's he talking about?
I'm sure there were people that were outside the city defending their fields and all sorts of stuff.
That's exactly it. These people have suffered horribly, and they had been pent up and captured inside this city. And they would have lost many of their relatives and friends who were captured in Sennacherib's excursions, you know, all around the city there, so that with their own eyes they have seen the devastation of everything outside the city walls. Verse 10, "Now, it is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his," and remember that's Yahweh, God of Israel, "that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, do not be negligent now, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, and that you should minister to him and burn incense." And then we get a list of names, which I'll not read tonight, but we have priests and Levites who were not priests. Remember, all priests are Levites, not all Levites are priests. And they are now, look at the right-hand column at verse 15, the second full paragraph. They gathered their brethren, sanctified themselves, went according to the command of the king, the words of the Lord, to cleanse the house of Yahweh. So they're like, okay, well, Hezekiah, if that's the way you want it, then let's get up and be busy. Now, before we go any farther, though, what have the priests and the Levites been doing if the temple is boarded up, full of rubbish? You have to, you know, kind of bust in to get to an east courtyard, and then you collect all these guys, and you've utterly failed. Let's straighten this out. What are they doing? Yeah, nothing. See? Or worse, maybe some of them participating in the idolatry. They were already priests or recognized as such. So we're not sure, but, you know, back to their own houses, back to, you know, who knows what, anything but taking care of the temple. And they are no longer sanctified. They haven't been keeping themselves physically and ceremonially purified by God's standards. They've just utterly turned away from everything. Now, we're going to turn the page to 669, or not turn it, I guess, but look over at 669, and we're going to start or continue the reading in 2 Chronicles 29 at verse 25, top left. He stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with stringed instruments, and with harps, according to the commandment of David, of Gad the king's seer, and of Nathan the prophet. For thus was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. I have a question for you. Was it just David's idea to introduce instruments of music into the Old Testament worship, or was it God's idea? It was God's idea. It was by David, by Gad the king's seer, by Nathan the prophet, and by the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. That's three ways after David that we are told this. I always emphasize this because I've found so many people among the Lord's people who think that David kind of did this on his own and that it was a mistake, that instrumental music was not God's command in the Old Testament. That passage says it was. It three times invokes either the names or the group of the prophets to say so. Certainly instrumental music was part of the Old Testament, just not at all a part of the New. Then Hezekiah commanded them to offer the burnt offering on the altar. When the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord began, with the trumpets and with the instruments of David, king of Israel. So all the assembly worshipped. The singers sang, the trumpeters sounded, all this until the burnt offering was finished. And when they had finished offering, the king and all who were present with him bowed and worshipped. Moreover, King Hezekiah and the leaders commanded the Levites to sing praise to the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. What words are those? What do we call those words? Psalms. So they got out their book of Psalms and they're singing them. So they sang praises with gladness and they bowed their heads and worshiped. It has always been a sign of respect to God in worship that the human head be bowed. It's not necessary, it's not sinful if you don't. Other physical bodily attitudes are acceptable, but that's a very standard way of doing it. So they have come with great joy, but they also come in humility, with bowed heads, and with a tremendous, you know, noise of musical instruments and voices singing, sacrifices being first killed and then burnt, you know, all the senses are involved in the pageantry of this now return of the temple to service. Now, let's skip down in that same column there about three-quarters of the way down and in the middle of the paragraph there. Look for verse 34. I know it's kind of hard to do, but they're right in the middle. But the priests were too few so that they could not skin all the burnt offerings. Therefore, their brethren, the Levites, helped them until the work was ended and until the other priests had sanctified themselves, for the Levites were more diligent in sanctifying themselves than the priests. So, very curious passage right there. Does this mean that these Levites did something that God had forbidden? And that because the priests were too few and weren't properly purified, that therefore the Levites could take over restricted activities here temporarily. Bill? Okay, if I understand what Bill's saying, that's correct. I don't think the Levites did anything out of line. It was just that normally the priest would have done all of this, and now it's shameful and it's sad that there's too many priests who are unclean to be able to go and offer these sacrifices. And Hezekiah is determined we're going to do this right. So there was apparently an investigation that took place, and if a man was not clean for whatever reason, then he was not going to be offering those sacrifices. They had to go look for these Levites then to step up into a position that they were allowed and authorized to do, but which was ordinarily or should have been unnecessary. Now I'm going to skip down further and start chapter 30 in that left-hand column on 669. And Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and also wrote letters to Ephraim, and there's a tribe up north, and Manasseh, another one, very far north, and that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Lord God of Israel. Wait a minute! I thought the 10 tribes were all destroyed, annihilated, and obliterated, and vaporized, and hauled off to Assyria. Who are these guys? Well, brother, it's true in any nation that when you, and it's going on right now in Syria, it's going on in Afghanistan, so many other places, that I understand this week to try to retake Fallujah again. We've been fighting over Fallujah for how many years now, and so they're not another offense in trying to get it back. And it's the ebb and flow of war. And when people lose battles, does every last breathing soul get killed or captured? Well, no, they flee off into the hills, you know, various people see this thing coming, they're smart enough, to get out of Dodge. And so then what do you do when Sennacherib in shame withdraws all of his people and goes back to Nineveh and gets killed by his own kids? What do you do now? You come out of the hills and you go home and you start rebuilding. Now, they've been hooked. So, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, set up the idol. They worshiped those idols in Dan and Bethel at the north and south of the 10 northern tribes for 200 years. But Sennacherib sure enough put an end to that. So now, when they come crawling back down out of the hills, what have they lost besides just field and farm and family? They've lost their illicit and unrighteous faith as well. Okay? So Hezekiah, smart cookie, he apparently realizes, well, look, you know, they've been thoroughly chastised. And how many prophets has Hezekiah known personally to explain all of this to him? It's because of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat's sin. See, but all that idolatry's been thrown down now by Sennacherib, and with him coming in the name of his gods. And so Hezekiah reaches out to his brethren, and that just warms my heart. For 208 years, Israel has been in apostasy. For 208 years, they've been fighting endless civil war battles among themselves. You know, it's just been terrible. And as soon as these 10 kingdoms, which have been such a thorn in the side most of the time, from the southern kingdom, gets just beaten to a bloody pulp, what does Hezekiah do first day, first month? Let's call our brethren home. Let's kill the fatted calf and rejoice and put a ring on him, you know, and bring him home. Let's bring the prodigal home. That just is a tiny little insight, I guess, you know, into the heart of Hezekiah. But isn't it a wonderful one that he would decide to do that? It just reveals, you know, the devotion he had to his God, his understanding about the people belonging together. And it meets with a fair amount of success, as a matter of fact. He writes the letters to finish it, that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, very bottom left-hand column, 669, to keep the Passover to the Lord. For the king and his leaders, top now, and all the assembly in Jerusalem had agreed to keep the Passover in the second month. So, runners are sent. You remember reading about the runners. Let's look at the first full paragraph in the right-hand column, starts with verse 6, but very much down toward the end of that paragraph. Look for verse 9. If you return to the Lord, your brethren and your children will be treated with compassion, by those who led them captive, so that they may come back to this land. For the Lord your God is gracious and merciful and will not turn his face from you if you return to him. What promise is Hezekiah offering now? Even in Assyria, all the way to Nineveh, you in the north have lost family who have become slaves. But Hezekiah says to them, you know what? I believe we have a future. And if you will turn from your idolatry and come on home and worship Jehovah with us, then God, he believes, and I'm thinking that in his ear, Isaiah, for instance, and others of these prophets have been telling him so, or he wouldn't take it upon himself to say such a thing, that some of those people are going to be able to come back. And eventually, we're going to see this kingdom rise again. And so, once more, it's just wonderful to have this insight into his heart to receive these people and appeal to them and then represent God as being compassionate and wanting to forgive. Now, looking at verse 10, that's the second full paragraph in the right-hand column. We're in 2 Chronicles 30 still, verse 10. So the runners passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun. But they laughed at them and mocked them. Nevertheless, some from Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. So he met with success. But what did he also meet with? Yeah, ridicule, complete rejection. And so, Brad, it's never been that way. It's always going to be that way. When you reach out with the truth of the gospel, then only good hearts are going to respond. The other hearts, they're going to respond, but they're going to respond by being in your face, you know, and mistreating you. So just get ready, you know, get used to it. And Hezekiah's experiencing this in his time. Okay, let's turn the page, 670 now. We're still reading 2 Chronicles 30. And right at the very top there, it's the third line in the middle, is verse 18. For a multitude of the people, many from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, we now have four tribes that are named. Two that he sent runners to, we're told. A third tribe has responded. Now a fourth tribe has responded, but had not cleansed themselves. Yet they ate the Passover, and now we are told, contrary to what was written. But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, may the good Yahweh provide atonement for everyone who prepares his heart to seek God, the Yahweh God of his fathers, though he is not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary. And the Lord listened to Hezekiah and healed the people. Now, that "and healed the people" suggests that maybe some sort of plague or something, some kind of punishment was also taking place. I don't know any more about it than that line, but some kind of healing had to take place. Maybe it's spiritual, maybe this means forgiveness of sins, I'm not sure, but they were suffering somehow, and so the Lord forgave them. And again, you have God willing to forgive outright misbehavior and sin. Okay? But did Moses ever pray for a sinful people? Sure. And did God ever relent then and forgive? Sure. That's why one of the first things Hezekiah had to do was to tear down, polarize, and dispose of what? That serpent that Moses had built up, which the people had come to worship. But the serpent itself was a symbol of a sinful people being what by God? Forgiven and healed. Okay, forgiven and healed. You're all right, but it's the two I'm looking for because we got this healing going on here too. So I'm not sure what it is. But they're all forgiven. Now, continuing in chapter 30, pretty significant chapter, you see the first full paragraph in the left-hand column starts with verse 21. So the children of Israel who were present at Jerusalem kept the feast of unleavened bread. That unleavened bread is immediately associated with and now takes its own name for the other feast. But the other feast, the one we usually refer to this as, is not just the feast of unleavened bread, but it's the feast that is called what? Passover. That is correct. During that week, they had to have no leaven in the house. So feast of unleavened bread, feast of Passover, talking about the same time frame. And so, 7 days with great gladness, and the Levites and the priests praised the Lord day by day, singing to the Lord, accompanied by loud instruments. This was not a single event for a couple of hours. Day by day, for a week, they're having the Passover again. So at the very bottom of that column, the next to the last line on that column on page 70, we're going to be looking at the last few verses, starting with verse 26 of 2 Chronicles 30. So there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem. Can you give me one more reason why the people at this time would be especially, really rejoicing? Who just left town? Sennacherib. Okay? Now there's cause for rejoicing and dancing and singing in the streets, you know, all by itself. So everybody here, they're just out of their minds with joy and reestablishing their covenant relationship with their God. And we haven't seen anything like this since Solomon, who died in 930 B.C. Okay, so now let's start chapter 31, still there on page 670. When all this was finished, all Israel who were present went out to the cities of Judah, broke the sacred pillars in pieces, cut down the wooden images, threw down the high places in the altars from all Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh, till they had utterly destroyed them all. And then all the children of Israel returned to their own cities, every man to his possession. Were they done at the end of the Passover unleavened week feast day? No. They left Jerusalem, then what did they do? They scoured the land looking for what? Idols. What did they do to them? They pulverized them. Okay? We are starting over, and good for them. Now, in 671, the middle of the left-hand column, we're still in 2 Chronicles 31. We're going to start there with that second full paragraph at verse 16. Besides those males from 3 years old and up who were written in the genealogy, that one leaked off the page for me this week. I don't remember having ever read that before, though I must have read it, you know, dozens of times. But I didn't realize, you know, it never stuck, that they actually, from 3 years old and up, were keeping those genealogical records, and what, the sentence continues, distributed to everyone who entered the house of the Lord his daily portion for the work of his service by his division. So besides the males, who are only 3 years old and up, then we also took care of the adults that were working in the temple. So there was a daily distribution, some sort of communal allotment, food likely, foremost, that is assigned to any guy, 3 years old and above. So the families are all being supported. The reading of verse 17, to the priests who were written in the genealogy according to their father's house, and to the Levites from 20 years old and up according to their work by their divisions, and to all who were written in the genealogy, their little ones and their wives, their sons and daughters, the whole company of them, for in their faithfulness they sanctified themselves in holiness. So, now the nation is rising up, you know, to take care of the priests and their families. The genealogy had been preserved despite all that had been going on with Sennacherib. Jerusalem still stood. That's the center where such things would be found. They are able to step right up and get this religion, you know, back together again. So the last paragraph in chapter 31, there at the bottom of 671's left-hand column is verse 20. Thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah. And he did what was good and right and true before the Lord his God in every work that he began in the service of the house of God, in the law and in the commandment to seek his God. He did it with all his heart. Now there's three words that follow. What are they? So he prospered. Now brethren, as far as I can tell, that promise is never ended. So, if you will, in every work that you begin in the service of your Lord and in the law and in the commandment, seek God with all your heart, then what's likely? You'll prosper too. Chapter 32, right-hand column, verse 24. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death, and he prayed to the Lord, and he spoke to him and gave him a sign. But Hezekiah did not repay according to the favor shown him, for his heart was lifted up. That's news we didn't get in last week's reading. Therefore, wrath was looming over him and over Judah and Jerusalem. Then Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord did not come upon them in the days of Hezekiah. Now, Bill, I can't remember if it was last week or week before, maybe now, you know, asked me about this, and I didn't remember this and hadn't read this far ahead. And so you remember he was absolutely right about that, and I just didn't recall that Hezekiah does have a strike against him, doesn't he? And this is it. And apparently, and again, we have to be really careful here because we're not told very much, but was his heart really right when he turned his face to the wall and prayed God to forgive him and let him live? Yes. And, you know, God said, okay, I'm going to give you 15 more years. So he lived to the age of 54 instead of dying at the age of 39. Think about that. Okay? Then he got up out of his sick bed and Isaiah told him, you got 15 more years. And what did his heart do then, apparently? Well, I must be pretty special in God's eyes. Look what I just pulled off. Says his heart was not humble. He pulled a Nebuchadnezzar. You'll hear about him in Daniel, but you're all familiar with it. And so he had that heart, you know, like an old heathen king. And he's going to have to pay for it. Now, fortunately, whatever was looming over him, he humbled himself again for the pride of his heart this time, and he prayed for the others as well, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the wrath of the Lord did not come upon him in the days of Hezekiah. So he again, because of his prayer and humility, receives the favor of God and forgiveness. Now, how forgiving is God? And if you just bestowed a big favor on the guy, I would give you 15 more years. That's more than bicycle I ever bought for my kids. What would you expect that king to be? Grateful. But like a kid, you know, he's not. And so he had, he was in trouble. God threatened him, and he was forgiven again. Wonderful guy, but fouls up like anybody. Carol, you had a hand up. Great illustration, and perhaps that's the very thing. We just don't have, you know, anything more but this paragraph to tell us about it. So yeah, he just didn't appreciate it. But he came to, didn't he? He sure enough came to. Okay, so then, brethren, let's look at verse 30, 32, 30 right down there toward the bottom of that column. The same Hezekiah also stopped the water outlet of Upper Gihon and brought the water by tunnel to the west side of the city of David. Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Now, if you look up at the screen here, I just selected a couple of quick pictures, but this is the Kidron Valley. Down in the valley, looking back up to the north, along, this is the south face of the Temple Mount, but the valley runs around on the east side right there. And you'll remember that when they're doing away with these idols and whatnot, they would haul the pieces down into the Kidron Valley and burn them and pulverize them and all of that would have been done here in this Kidron Valley, which, of course, in the rainy season will flow and wash all that stuff all the way down, by the way, to where? Water that flows through that canyon goes where in the end? Dead Sea. It goes all the way to the Dead Sea, lowest place on earth. So that, you know, is the Kidron Valley there, and it's right up here on this ridge just out of sight where the King's Palace and all of that would have been. So many of these events taking place right there. And then if you just spun around 180 degrees from where I took that last photograph and you look back this way, here's the Kidron Valley continuing on out, and you have these rocks which have been built up since the time of David to create that palace structure that's being uncovered as we speak. Archaeologists very actively digging there right now. So a lot of that taking place. And then since he just mentions his works, we spent so much time on the tunnel last week, I just briefly wanted to mention this structure
Don and I stood up here, you know, looked down on it, you can read the sign with the maps and whatnot, but it's really kind of a nondescript thing, I realize. Right in the old city of Jerusalem and not far from the Temple Mount, really. But those rocks
are another one of the great engineering triumphs and significant building projects of King Hezekiah.
Now, to this day, this is referred to as the Broad Wall.
And that is because, now you're turning and looking the other way, it's about 213 feet that's been exposed. But, you know, it's right in the middle of the city, as you saw, and so they've just preserved this one little section right here. But the excavations in the Jewish quarter of the city that unearthed this section, which was built by Hezekiah in the 700s, very late 700s B.C. This wall was intended to protect the city against the Assyrians. It was almost 24 feet thick and 24 feet high in Hezekiah's time, and is an important archaeological site now, since it located the city's boundaries in Hezekiah's day, which were unknown before these excavations, which took place in 1974. Isaiah 22, 9 and 10, though I didn't point it out in our reading, mentions this wall. And its name will be used later, after the seven-year captivity, when Nehemiah returns from that captivity and rebuilds the city's walls. On the western section, he reused Hezekiah's work. Just as Nehemiah 3:8 says, they fortified Jerusalem unto the what? The Broad Wall, 24 feet thick, 24 feet broad. So it's a very important archaeological find there. Now, you see why I say we have so much time here this evening.
On pages 673, 4, 5, and 6, we hear about Manasseh, Ammon, and Josiah, but I'm going to skip them entirely this week. You're going to read all about them all over again in this next week's reading. So I'm going to save that material, which is a little more full, in the second reading for next week. We'll get to all of that next week
while we close out our class tonight with just 15 minutes, but I thought it would be a good idea to try to focus
on this little prophet Zephaniah. We have to go so rapidly through these other prophets about tonight, God's duplication. Let's just look at Zephaniah a little more thoroughly, which, of course, you'll find on page 677 now,
and the left-hand column. So Zephaniah 1:1 identifies who Zephaniah is. The word of Yahweh, which came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah.
Now remember, we have skipped over Manasseh. You know, we've skipped a lot of history. We'll come back to history next week. But Zephaniah is apparently Hezekiah the king's great-great-grandson. And I say apparently. Does the verse say King Hezekiah? No, he doesn't. Was that the only guy in Israeli history who ever bore the name Hezekiah? Unlikely. So we're kind of presuming here, but it appears nonetheless that likely, or certainly at least possible, that Hezekiah's great-great-grandson is Zephaniah. And Zephaniah writes what is probably around 625 to 630 B.C.
He is going to be writing what is a tough, tough prophecy. Assyria is in a serious state of decline now. Babylon is the next big deal. And they are really going to be a big deal. So the predominating message of Zephaniah is punishment.
Now I tried to break it down into sections and give you just a little bit of an outline here, but in the beginning, verses 2 through 6, he is going to give the grounds for this upcoming punishment that's going to be taking place on Judah, the two southern tribes, in verses 2 through 6.
I will utterly consume everything from the face of the land, says Yahweh. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, the stumbling blocks along with the wicked. I will cut off man from the face of the land, says the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off every trace of Baal from this place. How long has Baal been giving us fits? That old idol's been around for several hundred years now. And several times, his worship has been expunged from God's people. But what inevitably happened? It kept on coming back. Okay? And so time and again, some bad king would rise up, and here that Baal worship shows up once again. The names of the idolatrous priests with the pagan priests, now verse 5, those who worship the host of heaven on the housetops, those who worship and swear oaths by Yahweh, but who also swear by Milcom. Whoa! And brother, this happens all the time, and it's happening to this day. Human beings just have a terrible penchant for wanting to take everything that God said and pay lip service to it, and then add whatever else they want and go about, you know, confidently believing that God doesn't care. You can just add whatever you want to his worship. Do whatever you want in his name. But as long as you're using his name, everything will be okay. Well, it won't. And so here they are swearing by Yahweh, but also by, you know, Molech is another name for this Milcom here. Those who have turned back from Yahweh and have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him. Now, brothers, they're swearing oaths to him. You would think they respected him some. But the last part of verse 6 says they don't seek the Lord. They're not inquiring of Yahweh. They're just invoking his name, see, and trying to have it both ways. That will get you killed. That will get you taken into captivity. Now, verses 7 through 13, he's going to tell us who the subjects of this punishment are. He stipulated the reasons, the grounds for it. Now let's read verses 7 to the end of that column on page 77. Zephaniah 1, verse 7. Be silent in the presence of the Lord Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. For the Lord has prepared a sacrifice. He has invited his guests. Now how do we know that Zephaniah is writing about 630, 625, possibly even later? Because this punishment is how far off? It is at hand. A thing that is at hand is near. It is not several hundred years away. In verse 8, it shall be in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with foreign apparel. And the same day I'll punish all those who leap over the threshold, who fill their master's houses with violence and deceit. Leaping over the threshold is the image of breaking into a house. There shall be on that day, says the Lord, the sound of a mournful cry from the fish gate and wailing from the second quarter and a loud crashing from the hills. Wail, you inhabitants of Maktesh, for all the merchant people are cut down. All those who handle money are cut off. And it shall come to pass at that time I'll search Jerusalem with the lamps and punish the men who are settled in complacency, who say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, nor will he do evil. Therefore, their goods shall become booty, and their houses a desolation. They shall build houses, but not inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards, but not drink their wine. And so, who's going to be punished? Well, it's pretty specific. It's everybody, you know, in Jerusalem and Judah there, and gives the list of their crimes. Now, just turning the page, continuing in Zephaniah 1 at verse 14 through 18, we have further description of this punishment. The great day of the Lord is what? Old Testament or new, what does near mean? Close at hand. So when you're reading a book that says these things will shortly come to pass or the time is near, what should you be thinking in terms of chronologically? Short. Okay? It is near, he repeats, and hastens quickly. The book tells you something's coming quickly. Don't look hundreds of years into the future. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. There the mighty men shall cry out. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of devastation and desolation, the day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, the day of trumpet and alarm. against the fortified cities, against the high towers. I will bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men, because they've sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like refuse. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of Yahweh's wrath. But the holy shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he will make speedy riddance of all those who dwell in the land. Not shaping up too well for Judah, is it? In chapter 2, that's not the only ones the Lord's upset about or with. So in Zephaniah chapter 2, let's start the reading at verses 4 through 13. Gaza shall be forsaken, Ashkelon desolate. They shall drive out Ashdod at noonday, and Ekron shall be uprooted. Remember, all four of those are the old Philistine cities. Woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of the Kerethites. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines. I will destroy you, so there shall be no inhabitant. The seacoast shall be pastures with shelters for shepherds and folds for flocks. The coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. They shall feed their flocks there. In the houses of Ashkelon they shall lie down at evening. Brethren, if you're living in Judah and you're living up in Jerusalem, do you want to go live in the old Philistine cities? No. But they're in better shape than Jerusalem. So he's talking about, you know, winding up with these few remnants again, or winding up in a place they'd never want to live, an unclean place. The end of verse 7, the Lord their God will intervene for them and return their captives. That is the theme not just in Jeremiah, but here in Zephaniah as well. I have heard the reproach of Moab and the insults of the people of Ammon, and with which they have reproached my people, made arrogant threats against their borders. Therefore, as I live, says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab shall be like Sodom, and the people of Ammon like Gomorrah, overrun with weeds and salt pits and perpetual desolation. If you turn to the next page at verse 12, the Ethiopians are mentioned. You get to verse 13, he'll stretch out his hand against the north, destroy Assyria, make Nineveh a desolation as dry as the wilderness. So who's going down when Babylon shows up? Everybody's going down when Babylon shows up. Jerusalem stood against Sennacherib. Stood miraculously against Sennacherib. An angelic, you know, miraculous preservation. And that isn't going to happen this next time. So, four nations going down too, and we'll close with chapter 3, the final chapter of the book, and just the first few verses there, 3 through 5. Her princes in her midst are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves that leave not a bone till morning. Her prophets are insolent, treacherous people. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They've done violence to the law. The Lord is righteous in her midst. He will do no unrighteousness. Every morning he brings his justice to light. He never fails. But the unjust knows no shame. Excuse me. Yeah, I suggest, you know, that's eerily similar to us. Brethren, in the United States today, isn't it exactly the same that everybody wants to have it both ways? So we're all singing the praises, you know, as a nation of the God of the Bible. And then we've got 2,000 denominational churches which only exist because they've decided to set up practices and doctrines that are utterly alien to Scripture. They want Yahweh and they want Molech simultaneously. Does that work? That will never work. And we got our fair share. Yet another one busted this week. What is another senator, whoever it was, McAuliffe is his name, you know, is under another FBI investigation. There's no end to those. You know, they do injustice to the law, whether it's the law of God or the law of man. There's violence everywhere, you know. What are you watching on the news these days? It's just, you know, mind-boggling. We haven't seen anything like this since 1968. You know, this presidential election that's going on and just riots, you know, and not riots, riots because of police problems that we've had, but this last couple of days, you know, now we're getting just fistfights and stuff, you know, going on. And you know, just it's funny to me how much it seems like we are, in numerous ways, you know, like those old people. Don't think it'll go any better for us. You know, I forgot I had one more uplifting section, but I'm out of time. How does the book close in chapter 3, verses 8 through 20? With a long section of God's promises that, you know what? It's still not the total end. There will be, see, a fulfillment of God's plans and God's purposes. So even in this book, as desperately unhappy as it's been, it closes off, see, with 13 verses about God's promises to come. Okay, well, there's our buzzer. Any final, have to be quick, comment or question?